Good afternoon. So last time, we finished up talking about caching by talking about a very special type of cache called the translation look-aside buffer. If this weren't named by IBM, maybe it would be called like a last level page table entry cache. And the purpose of this is to speed up our page table lookups by not doing the full lookup process most of the time. Most of the time we check the cache to see, do you have the result of this lookup from a virtual page number to our actual page table entry? And just get that without actually checking the page tables sort of in a sequence like your translate function for the page table assignment should be doing. Then we started talking about threads. We talked a little about sort of what, you know, sort of kind of reasons we use multiple threads. We have one process which shares all its sort of memory, its same heap, same global variables, but we have multiple threads in it. We shared some reasons why we might want to do that, and we started looking at the interface that pthreads, which is the POSIX, the Unix, basically, sort of threading interface provides for doing that. And we saw we had these functions that are kind of analogous to what we saw for process management. So we had pthread create, which is kind of like fork and exec. Except we're not starting a new process, we're running something in the same process. And with pthread create, we specify what function to start running in the new thread rather than having this function return twice. And pthread join, which is kind of like wait PID, in that it collects the return value of the thread function, and also, in order to do that, needs to wait for the thread to finish if it has not already. And like wait PID, it turns out we can call this before or after the thread finish, and pthread join will, you know, wait if necessary, or just return right away if it's already finished and we haven't collected the return value already. And also, I'll mention some logistic things again. So I'm not here the rest of this week. Professor Skadron should be covering lecture here on Thursday. The lab tomorrow, as I've mentioned a couple times, is the code review. This means page table 2 is due before the lab, and I mean before the first lab. And it's in person. If you haven't emailed me and you can't attend in person, that's not going to work. You should do so as soon as possible, so we can make some alternate arrangements, which will be when they have to be. So questions about things we covered last time or logistics for the rest of the week? Yes. The question is, if I write a application that uses pthreads, but I'm doing it for, you know, not performance reasons, so, and I'm expecting to run in a processor that can only run a single thread at a time, you know, is it going to take advantage of multiple threaded processors and so on if I have them? Yes, that would be an advantage you might have from that technique. But on a single threaded processor, we're just, the OS is going to do the context switching to simulate the multiple threads sort of running at the same time, even though they physically won't be doing that. Does that answer your question? Okay. And so I have slides for the quiz. I'm only going to talk about one question, which was about the case where we said we had this array and we had two addresses that were this far apart, which happens to be one page, and they map to the same cache set, even though, but the cache had enough cache sets to store things much further apart, bites apart, that number of bytes apart in different sets, right? If you look counted the number of sets divided by the block size, you found out, oh, these could have been stored in different sets. What happened to make that not happen? Well, the reason that this happened is that our caches generally work with physical addresses. It is possible to make caches with don't. That creates a bunch of other complications. So most processors choose that the caches are after we do all our page table lookups. They work with physical addresses, and that means that the physical addresses might have index bits, and those are the ones that are going to matter. And sometimes the index bits come from part of the page number in the physical address, and that's not necessarily the same as the page number in the virtual address. And that would be how we would get the situation we described in question 5. If we had sort of our consecutive virtual page numbers mapping to consecutive physical page numbers, well, the index bits would be different, since it turned out that the ones that were the same were the least significant bit of the physical page numbers, just by how the layout worked out. Questions on that quiz question or other ones? Yes. Question, how could here be printed after the thread function returns? So once we start a thread, even before, sometimes slightly before pthread create returns, the thread is running and eligible to execute. And it's just up to the OS when it runs it. And we can think of all those things are possible, it's just how fast is it until the OS gets a chance to start running the thread. And sort of all those are possible. Some of them are less likely than others. But the simplest way to think about it is we have a single core, right? The OS could decide that when you call pthread create, it's going to switch to the thread right away and run it until it finishes. Or it could decide not to run it until much later. And both of those are possible. And we also have kind of more things which could go on if we have a separate core the thread could run on that could start sort kind of at any time. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there. Yes, so the question is, where did I get 12 bytes? So when we're writing 4 bytes to a 16-byte block, and we want to store the whole block, what we can do is the cache, and what the cache we'll probably try to do is we can read the 12 bytes that aren't being overwritten from the memory and get the 4 bytes the processor wants us to write, combine them together, and store those in the cache. Does that answer your question?
Yes, so that saves reading 4 bytes.
That saves reading 4 bytes, yes. Other questions? Okay. So I'd like to go into some issues about pthread join and creating threads that we kind of skipped over just very briefly. So pthread join, you mentioned, allows collecting the thread return value. This means that if you have a thread and you haven't joined it, something is storing that return value. It's just a one pointer, but something has to store that in case you need it. So this means that if you pthread create a thread and don't pthread join it, that's a memory leak. And if you keep doing that, eventually you run out of resources. So if you want to avoid this, you would all need to have some way of always joining the thread. And sometimes you want to write code where maybe that doesn't make sense, where you just want the thread to run and you don't want to care about it. So pthreads has an interface for that case called detaching the thread. And a detached thread is not joinable, and that means that when the thread exits, it's not going to do any bookkeeping to keep track of the return value because it knows you don't care. And the way you make a detached thread, so one way you can do is if you create a thread, you can call pthread detach at any time, and that's just going to tell the pthread library, I'm never joining this thread. Don't keep any information around once it finishes. And you might complain, well, you know, this seems kind of a little weird that we're creating this thread that we don't really want to check on. And then we're changing its settings to detach it. You know, is there some way of just creating the thread and telling pthreads at that time that I'm never going to join this? And there is. And that's one of the uses of this argument here. We've always been passing null for, so that we can pass what the pthreads documentation calls thread attributes. And those attributes can include saying that the thread should start detached, meaning we'll never join it. And so here's sort of the syntax for doing that. We create this pthreads attributes object and set the detached state setting in it. And I'm not expecting you to memorize this. I have to look up these interfaces every time I care. So questions on detaching detached threads? I'll go back to. Okay. And yes, back there.
Just like how you can wait for specific PIDs, are you able to, is there some way that a process would be able to attach a thread?
Can I attach a thread? You mean after I've detached it?
Yeah, like as if it starts to attach, would you be able to write a process that takes a PID or some information?
So I'm not aware of one. My understanding is once you detach a thread, you can't go back on that decision. There may be some weird way of avoiding that, but I'm not aware of it. Yeah, question? Oh, okay. And so in this here, you saw one thing we could use that argument we were previously passing null for, that second argument to pthread create. There's some other settings you could put in there, and this will answer one question some people, if you thought about how many threads can we start, you may have had, which is about stack sizes. So we showed that when we start a thread, we create a stack for that thread, and that takes up some amount of space. How much space does it take up? Well, there's some default. But it turns out you can override that. And why would you want to do this? Well, if you're starting 1,000 threads and the default stack size is like 2 meg, maybe that's a problem. And you can set something smaller, knowing that, like, you know, if you're setting this stack size of 32 kilobytes, probably you're doing that with the knowledge that, like, you're not calling the Ackerman function in that thread, probably. Okay. So that's some stuff on pthread create and join. And now we're going to go into other issues with programming with multiple threads. And we're going to address sort of the primary difficulty with that, which is race conditions. And we saw a race condition in this example earlier, that here I have this code where I create a thread, and the thread prints something out, and my main thread prints something out, and then exits. And we had this question of whether the thread would be able to print out something first, or a main thread would exit first. And depending on who won that race, we get different outputs. And this was non-deterministic, which is really annoying if, you know, for this example, like, we don't really care about the output, but if we're writing a program which is like computing on numbers where we like want to have the right answer, it's pretty concerning that our program's behavior is basically random. You probably don't want that. And this is going to be our primary difficulty we're going to have to work around of programming with multiple threads, is that we don't want to have this kind of non-determinism. But, you know, it sort of comes up naturally and by accident all the time if you sort of try to do the natural things we're used to doing for single-threaded code in multi-threaded code. And we're going to learn about what we'll call synchronization constructs. So they're things that For us, the pthreads library provides, if you're not using the Unix threading library, that your threading libraries will provide. So like if you're using Java, Java has a whole bunch of equivalents of all of these, for example. But your libraries will provide some functions intended for coordinating between multiple threads. And we're going to learn about a subset of those. And to motivate that, I'm going to give an example of kind of a classical race condition where it actually makes a big problem, and where you can see it happens kind of by accident and not super intuitive. And I'm going to say, let's say we're running a bunch of ATMs, and I have a server that the ATMs connect to, which accepts withdraw and deposit commands from those ATMs. And I'm going to implement that server with a loop, which is going to get a request from an ATM, figure out whether to do a deposit, withdrawal, whatever. And you know, my code is, you know, my very simple code is that I'm going to get a struct that represents the account. I'm going to change the account balance, and then set that, update that. And probably in the real code, we like have some checks that we're not like, you know, the numbers are okay and more. But you know, this is kind of a very basic idea. And let's say, you know, I have the server running on a multi-core machine, so I'm going to run multiple copies of server loop in different threads. That should be a way to take advantage of the multiple cores. You know, and if I'm running a million ATMs, I probably want to do that so I can, you know, scale up to that. Or even if I don't have multiple cores, maybe this save account updates operation like writes to disk, and I want to have the OS run other things while waiting for the disk to actually do the write, because we learned that that can take some time. But for whatever reason, we have a multi-threaded server, let's say. So I have my main function starts a bunch of these server threads, and they're just running. And let's say we have two people try to deposit to the same account at the same time. And it may look like, if this is my deposit function, well, that what's going to happen is that I'm going to have two instances of this, and the first one, you know, might get the account, then do the deposit, and then maybe the second one starts running, gets the account, adds to the balance, and then the first one saves the result, and the second one saves the result. And you might say, well, you know, this seems fine because, you know, we're going to have these two increments happen. We don't know what order they'll happen in, but that doesn't really matter. So you might say, this doesn't seem like it will actually be a problem, provided that, like, get account always returns the same thing for our account. But it turns out it is a problem. And it's even a problem if, you know, it's even a problem even though this operation here, you know, kind of looks like it's just adding to a value what could go wrong, because you have to think, well, this is not implemented in C when the processor runs it, it's implemented in assembly. And here's, I have some very straightforward assembly for implementing that. Of course, not the only assembly my compiler could generate, but, you know, I get the account balance from memory with a move instruction, because it turns out in x86 assembly, I can't have an add instruction that takes two memory locations, so I'm putting that in a register. Then I'm adding to it from my variable in memory, then I'm storing it back. That's how I implemented that instruction, and I have a hypothetical, really unlikely, but really problematic set of context switches. That somehow an exception happened, and even if we're running on a single core, maybe the OS decided to switch between the two threads here, and then here. So on a single core, this seems like possible, but somewhat unlikely. If we have multiple cores, well, these things could be running at the same time. We don't even need a context switch for this kind of order to happen. We just need kind of the relative speeds of the two processors to work out that way. But whatever, you know, the case is, we have a possibility that we get this situation, and if we're doing like millions of transactions, probably going to happen eventually. And what happens here is that this here is the original balance plus amount, This is also the original balance plus amount. And that's what we end up storing back twice. And in effect, we've lost this right here. So we write this to the balance, then it's immediately overwritten without taking that change into account. So thread B kind of is the last to write to the balance, and its answer wins, even though it didn't compute its answer based knowing what thread A was doing. And we've lost, one of the deposits. So we're going to want to avoid this situation, and I'm pointing out this way that this can happen even when it's not immediately obvious from the C code, where something could run, because things get divided up into instructions. And those instructions might, don't just do a line at a time, they do smaller pieces at a time. So questions on this example race condition? Yeah. So question, why do we have to write twice? Because these are two different threads. The code that's doing this is this code, and there's nothing in here to detect, is there another thread also acting on the same account? Right, so it's written as if there's only one thread at a time, because that's the most common case. Right, and if we wanted to somehow realize there was another thread, we'd first have to somehow detect that, and secondly, this RAX here is different than this RAX here because every thread is kind of a virtual processor. It has its own value of all the registers. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So before we introduce synchronization mechanisms, let's think about what can race conditions do. I'm going to start out with, so let's say I'm writing these two operations here. I have thread A assigning to a global variable x, 1, and thread B assigning to a global variable y, 2, and initially x and y are both 0. What's the possible resulting values of x and y? One possibility. Any one. Yeah. Okay, x could be 1, and what about y? Y would be 2. So that's the most logical possibility, is that each of these operations just happens independently. And that's what we're going to hope, right? That kind of if we have separate variables, that x is 1, y is 2, and thread B, because it's not manipulating x, hopefully doesn't change it. And generally, we're going to assume things are written this way, even though, we're going to assume our compiler doesn't do something funny, like load x and y, change the x part, store x and y together to mess this up. But, that's actually something we need to have that kind of guarantee written down somewhere. Let's try this one. So what are possible values of x here? If we run, let these two threads run. Maybe one possibility. Yeah?
It could be one.
Could be one? How did you get that?
Thread A runs before thread B runs, and y will still zero at that point, so x
could
be one.
Okay, yeah, so if we run thread A, then all thread B. Other possibilities, yeah? Could be 5, how do you get that? What, thread? Okay, thread B finishes, so we run thread B, then we run thread A. Okay, any others? Yeah. Yeah, so first thread of thread B runs, then we switch to thread A, or maybe they're running on different cores and just get into relief like that. Okay. So those are sort of three possibilities that we could have. Let's try this one. So give me one possibility. Yeah. So we got one, and how do we get that? Okay. Another possibility? Not a trick question here. Yeah. Okay, if we run thread A and then thread A is assigned to thread A. Any others? Yeah. So could it be zero if we detach both threads? I'm assuming we wait for the threads to finish running in some way. Like we somehow wait long enough that both threads get a chance to run to completion. But yes, if we didn't do that, we would observe zero at some point in this process. So one or two are kind of the logical answers. I'm going to give you a proposal for why not three? Well, we're kind of assuming that this assignment happens all at once. What if we just do it one bit at a time? That's a valid way to implement this assignment. You don't have to assign the whole thing at once. You can do it in pieces. And then, this could get interleaved in this way, where, we managed to get one, a one in the least significant bit from A, and one in the second least significant bit from B as the winners of our race. And I can give you a similar option for our previous thing with X and Y. Why not seven? If we assign Y in pieces, we could see these intermediate values and make that happen. And if we think of these sorts of possibilities, it's going to be really hard to reason about what can actually happen when we have multiple threads accessing the same thing. So we're going to limit these in some way. Yes?
So in theory, are like context switches completely arbitrary? They can happen within a line?
Question, in theory, are context switches completely arbitrary? They can happen within a line? We're going to address that precisely on the next line. Yeah.
Could it be zero?
I think we can probably come up with zero if we do the bit assignment in another order. Yeah. Yeah. So we got all these weird possibilities. So to actually reason about what happens with multiple threads, we're going to have this concept of an atomic operation. And this is something that either happens all at once or not at all. And this is something we'll use to make threads work together. For the most part, we'll use sort of operations that are specifically intended to be atomic to help us out in coordinating threads. But they'll have this property that they're not going to get half done. They're either going to appear to be completely done or not done at all. They're not going to be some midway state that we can observe. Obviously they might have multiple steps, but it's not going to matter if they're halfway done. It's not going to affect our results. And on most modern machines, it turns out that yes, the things you'd kind of expect to be one operation are. So most notably, in our examples, you kind of intuitively thought assigning to X and assigning to Y, they're just integers. That should be one thing that happens or doesn't happen. It doesn't need to have happening pieces. And most machines, sort of loading and storing words, meaning sort of the native register size, so an X64 bit x86, that's 64 bits. If we had a 32-bit machine, it would be 32 bits. Usually that is atomic if they're aligned, meaning that if they're only in one cache block. But there's some instructions, that aren't atomic. So I said loading and storing values is atomic, but some individual instructions aren't atomic. And I'm pointing this out because this is kind of non-intuitive, because Something you might have said about my original example here is, well, the problem is that I implemented this plus equals operation with three instructions. And if you understand the x86 assembly, you might realize, wait a moment, there's a way of writing this where the add is one instruction. Because I can actually write sort of add R8 to some memory location. And that memory location could be where the account balance is stored. So I could do the add with one instruction. And in that case, it seems like I wouldn't have to worry about missing this write, because there'd be one instruction adding for thread A, one instruction adding for thread B. There's no chance to have the context switches work out where we read the wrong value. And on a single core, this would in fact work, because we can't sort of stop a program in the middle of a thread with an exception and then start it back later. The problem is that even though it's one instruction, doesn't mean it's atomic. So we have multiple cores. It turns out that we can notice that some individual instructions are actually executed in multiple steps, and we can see a state that's kind of in between another core. We're observing like the memory locations those instructions change. And the x86 instruction that adds to a memory location works that way. So it's not, even though it's one instruction in assembly, the processor implements it in multiple steps, and those steps kind of can get interleaved with stuff other processors are doing to the memory in noticeable ways. And to illustrate that, here I have a program that we run this add instruction. So here I'm adding one to a global variable with one instruction. I can do that on x86 assembly. That's what I'm doing. And I have a loop that runs that a bunch of times, in this case, a million times. And I'm doing that from two different threads. And if this was just one core and we were context switching between the threads, we'd expect that the resulting value of the global variable would be exactly 2 million. We'd add one to it a million times from thread A and a million times from thread B. Those adds would run in some order. We'd be context switching between them. But on my desktop, where I have multiple cores and these threads run on two different cores, that is very much not what happens. And instead, we have a race condition because that the add instruction is kind of split up into a load the value, add to it, store the value internally by the processor. And I have a histogram of the actual results I got running this a bunch of times. And this dotted line here, that's the value if we were running it on a single core. So we have a lot of missed writes, and in fact, sometimes we have the really fun, we somehow got a value that is less than what a single core would, single thread would give us, because of sort of how the operations were interpreted. Yeah. So this here, this is at a million, and that's the result we get if only one thread's answer one. And that seems to happen, sort of be the most frequent outcome. So basically what's happening is basically the way the processor works is it lets one thread do all its adding and stores that to the cache basically, and it overwrites what the other thread was doing effectively is what happens, or each thread like kind of keeps their own value and they don't actually synchronize like they're supposed to. You expect them to. And we also have this thing where somehow they're reading like a lower value than there really is at some point in the middle and getting a lower final result that gets stored. So all these kind of weird things are possible depending on the relative order of the kind of sort of sub-instruction operations that are happening between the two cores running this. And I'm not telling you this because I expect you to reason about what the actual output of this code would be. But to point out that if you want to have predictable output, you can't rely on anything that's not atomic unless, without doing something to make sure things are happening when you expect them to explicitly. So for now, I'm going to assume that loading and storing 64-bit values is atomic. And if you actually want to know what operations are guaranteed to be atomic, what's going to be safe to do with multiple cores, the processor designer will tell you. So if you read Intel's documentation, they will tell you what things will work the expected way with multiple cores, what won't, how you can, you know, make sure that everything you've done gets synchronized to the other cores. They have sort of documentation on how to do that, and that's what you need to rely on because they're responsible for making the caches and the execution of individual instructions work consistent with that. Yeah. So this is like one first piece of bad news I've given for the idea that let's just write code and just make sure, you know, and try to reason by hand about what's going to happen when I run this code that uses the same variables for multiple cores. And there's actually some other problems that we'll encounter. So here, I wrote assembly, and one reason I wrote assembly is so it's very clear what's an individual instruction. But another is that, like, the compiler can do weird things when it compiles my code. And one way it does this is when, you know, I'm writing code that's intended to be used with multiple cores, the compiler kind of by default assumes all the functions you run are running on a single, are single threaded, that there's no other thread involved. And a good example of how it takes advantage of this, I have this function here. So the intention of this function is to wait for the ready variable to become true. And it's a global variable, so it sure seems like, you know, it could be set from elsewhere. But the compiler is allowed to assume this is the only code running. And it takes advantage of that by saying, well, if this is the only code running, then the value of the ready variable is whatever it was at the start of this function, because this code doesn't change ready. And it says, okay, well, it's much faster to read a variable from a register than from memory, so we're going to move it to a register. Just keep it there. And so this becomes, and so if ready is false when this function starts, this is just an infinite loop the way the compiler compiled it. And this is 100% okay according to C and POSIX people. Their standard documents say what the compiler needs to do, and they say, this is fine. Go ahead and do that. You might also notice if you're thinking about signals that you might have ready set by a signal handler, still not gonna work. And that's why the signals lab said to use a volatile variable and or run like pause or some function, use sleep in the signal handler, in the loops like this. So this is 100% allowed and something the compiler is doing. And the way this slide is referring to is that the compiler is just moving the load. So we have to load the value of ready. And this code is written, loads at every iteration of the loop. The compiler's done an optimization where it says, well, it doesn't change from the beginning of the function to the loop, so I'm just going to load it at the beginning of the function. Another example of this, I can show you here, the compiler moving stores. So in this code here, now I'm setting this variable is waiting to 1 and then 0. And my clear intention is that something else is going to look at is waiting while we're in that loop. And then, you know, notice if we're waiting or not. But the compiler, when it generates my assembly, it generates the rate of 0, but not the rate of 1. It's again saying, if this is the only thing running, well, nothing checks is waiting between the beginning and the end. So I don't need to write it twice. I only need the last value, that's the only one that matters. Because the compiler, again, is compiling as if this is the only thread running. So, this is another case where if you just try to coordinate threads without special functions, the compiler's, it's assuming you're not doing that, and it's gonna compile your code in ways which will get you in trouble. Because it's assuming that you're not doing it. questions? These examples of compilers moving loads and stores around or removing them. Yeah. Question with Clang or GCC, is this a base level optimization? I think this happens at 01 with Clang or GCC, the, you know, because both of these optimizations are very, are like pretty simple optimizations. I'm not 100% sure, but they don't require a lot of analysis to figure out. Yeah, but I haven't explicitly checked. Other questions? So, you mentioned optimization flags. So yes, there are ways to tell compilers not to do these optimizations. And there are ways where you don't say, don't optimize anything. There's like things in between you can do. You can like say, like in the VM virtual memory explorer lab, we learned, oh, marking a variable as volatile will keep the compiler from doing certain optimizations with it. And there are things like that you can do. But that's still not enough, because unfortunately, processors also move loads and stores around a little bit. They don't do as much as compilers do. They're not as aggressive, but they still do that. Do I have? Oh, I guess I move those slides. Well, I guess probably. So, I guess I don't have the slides for doing that. For showing that example, I might show that later, but probably I shouldn't for time. Shouldn't show it today for time anyways. Processors do these sorts of things a little bit too. And the main reason, sort of, this is between cores, and this is mainly sort of the reason they do this is that if we don't reorder things, then we're saying that if like we have to store a value and load a value, if we don't reorder things, we have to do that strictly in that order. That means we have to wait to start loading the value until after we've stored the first one. And processors don't like that. That makes things slow, so they relax the ordering a little bit. They have restrictions on how they do that. We're not going to go into exactly what those restrictions are, because our solution to the compiler and processor doing these things, so we're going to completely dodge the problem by using things that our pthreads and other libraries have provided, where they've said, we made sure this function works the way you expect. And it makes the code around it work the way you expect. So all the pthread functions we use are going to prevent this kind of reordering by either the compiler or the processor. So for example, pthread join is going to make sure that before it returns, everything the thread you were waiting for did is actually finished. Guaranteed. You know, you're never going to see the operations not done completely if you call pthread join. Pthread create is going to make sure that if you did any setup before calling pthread create, it's actually done before the thread starts running. And we're going to talk about some other functions that we'll talk about later, which are going to prevent all this reordering stuff and all these, you know, anything from being partially done. And therefore avoid these problems. And their implementation is going to have the sort of things to tell the compiler, hey, when you call this function, that means all the variables changed. So please reload them. So pthread create and pthread join and other functions are going to do that. So it means like if I had this code and I had a call to, you know, pthread join in here, that would guarantee the compiler cannot do this optimization where it preloads ready. It'd be disallowed. So questions about this sort of, that these operations sort of prevent this these kind of optimizations? Yeah. So include the pthread methods to change how it compiles code. I think it's better to think of it as the compiler is going to assume the pthread methods effectively change all the variables, right? So it's not going to like, just having the call in there is not going to do it, but calling it at a place where at the relevant place is going to make the compiler assume because you called this, when that gets called, things must have changed. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we're going to look at sort of a tool for synchronizing threads. That's going to be one of these pthread functions, you know, where the primary purpose is going to be making sure two threads work together in a way that makes sense for us. You know, pthread create and pthread join do that, but they're kind of very inflexible because, right, they only let us, like, coordinate threads when they're finishing. We probably want to coordinate threads while they're running. And the primary tool we're going to talk about is going to provide a property we'll know as mutual exclusion, which is going to ensure one thread does things at the same time. I guess I have my examples from elsewhere. Like, so we'll use our running example, like adding to a balance would be our example. So we want one thread to add to a balance at a time, for example. And there's going to be some, and I have some mocap terms here, which I'm mentioning because you'll probably see them somewhere. We call the code that one thread can execute at a time a critical section. Wow. Mutual exclusion. And we're going to have a sort of abstract object we're going to talk about as sort of our primary way of coordinating threads is going to be something called a lock. And this is going to be something for creating these critical sections, for providing this mutual exclusion of having one thread do something at a time. And with the name lock, you might think, I'm going to give you an analogy about like padlocks. And I'm going to deliberately avoid doing that because the locks we're using do not act like physical locks in a very important way, is that they're advisory. So with a physical lock, like you can't access something without doing something about the lock. That's not how the locks we have in pthreads, in most threading libraries, work. They don't actually stop you from doing anything. So let's go back to our sort of original problem. We had the deposit operation, and we wanted to change the balance. And the problem was we had two different threads changing the balance at a time. And I'm going to solve the problem that we change the balance at the same time by making an agreement that before I change the balance, I have my balance written down here, I'm going to put on this hat. Then I'm going to only change the balance while wearing this hat. Nothing actually stops me from not having the hat and changing the balance. I'm just going to agree we always put on the hat when we change the balance. And because only one person can wear the hat at the time, this is going to ensure that we take turns doing that. And we're going to wait to get the hat before we actually change the balance. And by having this agreement, that's going to ensure we take turns adding the balance. We don't have any conflicts. Yes?
So is it sort of like a talking stick?
Sort of like a talking stick? That would be another analogy, yes. Yeah?
How do we ensure that two people don't think that they're wearing the hat?
How do you ensure that two people don't think they're wearing the hat? So the pthreads library is going to implement this lock object, which is going to ensure that for us. So part of its implementation will be giving that property. Yes?
So, like you said, it's not like a lock where you can't access it. Like, how is it not binding?
How is it not binding? So if I, so we're going to see our example code that uses locks. We're going to do a lock and an unlock operation, and then edit the balance there. If I write code that just does balance plus equals dot, 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 that code's going to still run, and it's not going to try to get the lock. It's just going to edit the balance, and bad things will happen. So I need to ensure that when I write code to edit the balance, I use the lock. If I don't do that, it's not going to happen for me. Does that answer your question? Yeah, and that's the key thing I want to get across, because there are places where you have sort of locks which aren't. So the name I heard for this type of lock is advisory. Right? You have mandatory locks. These are not mandatory locks. They're mandatory in the sense your program won't work correctly if you don't use them right. But they're not mandatory in the sense the compiler's going to say anything's wrong. if you forget to use them. They're just going to let you do that, just like the compiler lets you dereference a null pointer. Yeah?
Are there any other implementations of critical section other than using lock object?
Question, are there other implementations of critical sections other than using lock object? Yes. We are not going to talk about probably the most common, which are semaphores, which you can kind of think of as a generalization of lock. They're in the reading. I guess we are going to talk about barriers, which you technically could use to implement a lock, I guess, but I wouldn't recommend it. Is that, yeah, but, and I guess we're talking about a lock, and our locks have this sort of acquire and release, or lock and unlock, both, you'll see both names, operations, and we didn't talk about how they're implemented. And there's actually a lot of different ways of implementing them. So to implement them, we're gonna have to have some way of coordinating with the OS and coordinating with the processor. That's not something we're gonna go in detail in this class. I have covered it when I've taught OS in the past, so I have like material on that, but there's multiple actual implementation techniques to provide these two operations. And our two operations are this lock, which is going to wait until the lock is free, and then get it, and unlock is going to free up the lock and therefore hand it off to some other thread, and that thread is waiting and stop them from waiting. Questions? Yes.
So any thread
Any thread that doesn't have possession of the lock, is it just frozen? If it called the lock operation, it's going to be frozen until it gets it. If it didn't call the lock operation, it just runs normally. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
So would it be possible that one thread, like let's say thread A, is waiting for the lock of thread B, and while the thread B is also waiting for A to release the lock?
So the question, is it possible to have kind of some circular dependency in threads waiting for locks? Yes, that is going to probably be most of what Professor Skadron talks about on Thursday, called deadlock. Because it is a problem we need to avoid. Other questions? Yeah?
Is there one lock for like the whole process, or is it like per function?
Question, is there one lock per whole process, or is it like per function? So a lock is an object you can create, like a struct, so you can make as many as you like. Yeah?
How does it know whether
we can or not? Let's say I'm trying to access some resource, how does it know whether it can or not? The lock doesn't check anything. All it checks is when you do the lock operation. So you have, when you call the lock operation, if it's the same lock object, the other thread locked earlier, then the lock is not free, assuming the other thread didn't unlock it. Otherwise, you know, it is free. So the lock only knows about who called lock and unlock on it. Does that answer your question? So you'll notice that, yeah, so the lock doesn't know, so you know when you're using a lock why you call lock and why you call unlock. So in this example, given that I named the object account lock, probably it's because I'm accessing the account. But the lock implementation doesn't know or care. All it knows is that this is the same lock that you called lock on or called unlock on earlier from somewhere else. Yeah. And we're gonna be able, you can create as many of these locks as you like. Typically, you'll have sort of one lock for every thing you want to be accessed, sort of taking turns. So commonly, it's kind of the bank account scenario, it makes sense that each bank account would have a lock because we don't want more than one thread accessing a bank account. But we probably don't want like one lock for the entire bank, because I would say everyone takes turns accessing the entire bank. Maybe we don't do that. Other questions? Okay. And I mentioned that our acquire operation, if someone has locked the lock earlier and not unlocked it, it's going to wait ideally, it's going to wait in a way where the OS gets the context switch away to do something else. That's not, you know, that's hopefully how these are implemented. That's a reason why we use a library, which hopefully knows how to do that in an intelligent way. But this means that we're going to like need coordination with the OS to make this work in a good way. And so I started to do kind of locks abstractly. Like here's sort of the API for using it from pthreads. So in our pthread library, we have a mutex object. So mutex stands for mutual exclusion, which is a type of lock. And I can declare as many as I like. I just have one I've declared here in this example. And I have to initialize it. There's two ways of doing that. I can use the pthread mutex init function, or I can use this special constant that sets up the initial values of the bookkeeping that's internal to the lock object. And then I use the lock operation and the unlock operation, passing a pointer to that object. Questions on this syntax? Yeah. Question, would the lock be a global variable? Typically, you'd store the lock alongside the thing that it's quote-unquote protecting. So if it's protecting a global variable, you'd store it as a global variable. Like if it's things in a struct, you'd probably have it, it'd be one of the thing members of the struct. And if it's a local variable, you, for some reason, it might have to be a local variable. That's protected. Other questions? Let's have some code with locks here. What are some possible values of 1 and 2, these two global variables, after this code runs? And assume string is an appropriate type alias to make this work. Can someone give me one possibility? One possible final value of 1 and 2? Yeah. Okay, they could both be the B value. And a way this can happen is that if thread B just runs last. So one possibility is we run thread A, then we run thread B to completion because once we've unlocked, right, there's no, so if we run thread A can run by itself, fine. Same with thread B. They can both run by themselves, fine, even with this lock, because they'll never wait. Because remember, we only wait on a lock operation if someone else has the lock. The way this code works, that we acquire the lock, then we release it. So when the threads return, the locks are not held, you know, afterwards. So one possibility is that the B value is the final value. And similarly, we can have the A value be the final value. That if the B thread runs first, then the A thread runs, that's possible. The locks don't make that impossible because we're just going to, you know, in this case, run B first. B is going to get the lock 1. It's free. It's going to get lock 2. It's free. It's going to release the two locks. Then A is going to run. It's going to try to get lock one. Well, since B just released lock one, it's free. It's going to again get lock two. Since B just released it, it's free. That's going to work without waiting if we have that order. Yeah?
So in this example, would it always finish either thread A or thread B before like switching to the other one?
In this example, would we always finish thread A or thread B before switching to the other one? No. So there's some other possibilities. Which I haven't. I've given the two easiest ones.
Yeah.
So, could someone give me another possibility? Yeah.
So could it be A1, then B1, then A2, then
B2? So you went A1, then B1, then A2, then B2. Okay, so you're saying that we're gonna get lock one in A, we're gonna run A1. And then we're going to get lock 1 and B, presumably only after A releases lit. You know, it has to wait potentially. And then A2 gets to run. So we're assuming that A, then A gets lock 2, and B has to presumably wait for lock 2. So it's probably what happened here, is that B was waiting for lock two and didn't get it until A finished its code there. Yeah, so that's a possibility. And in this case, we still end up, however, with a final answer of BB. That's just another way it could run and get the same answer. Same final results. Yes, back there?
Yeah, A1, B1.
So A1, B1, B2, A2. Yeah, so that's also possible. And that would be BA, yes. And the way that's possible is that we get A. So presumably what happens, you know, is that we get A1 runs, and while it's running, B1 tries to get the lock. It has to wait until after A1 finishes. And then A1 releases the lock, but it's too slow to get lock 2, so B2 gets to run first, and then A2 runs. So that'd be, a possibility. So we have all the possible combinations except AB. So let's think about AB. So we want to see if we can get A, B. And for this, we want an order where somehow the last thing that runs for B is B2, and the last thing, but that has to run before, it has to run after A2. But A1 needs to run there, and we want that order, right? To make that happen. So I'm just saying we want B2 to be last. We need we want A1 to be the last thing in 1. So that's the order it has to happen in. Is that possible? Answer, yeah.
I think A1 can be in between B1 and B1. Because once B1 runs, lock 1 is locked.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so this is not possible. And the reason why is that we have, that if we think of our two threads, so we have B1, from here on, we have lock 1 held until after B2 happens. And we're asking for A1 to squeeze in between there, but this is not going to work because sort of can't get lock 1 here to run A1. So we can't possibly run A1 there because we know that it has to wait until we finish B2 for that unlock that is at the very end of thread B here. So this is not actually possible. So questions? I came to that conclusion. Yeah.
Could A1,
B1, A2, B2 happen? Yes. That was one of our possibilities earlier. A1, B1, sorry, you said A1, B1, A2, B2? Yeah, that's fine, because to enter A2, we only need to get lock 2, and we can get that and just have B2 wait for us. Does that answer your question? Other questions on this? Okay, so key thing, so we're applying that, like, when we get a lock, we wait for no one else to have it, and whether they've had it is, have they called lock without calling unlock? And when we unlock the lock, that lets someone else who's waiting for a lock start running. And the locks kind of act independently, like each of them tracks, we lock them. And you'll notice that the implementation of lock and unlock here doesn't know or care which variables the lock is actually, quote unquote, protecting. It just sort of implements that waiting operation at the appropriate times, and that makes some things more possible and some not. And like the key thing it does here, which is, you know, kind of gloss over, is just that it makes sure that only one thread's attempting to modify one and two at a time. Right, that's something we've definitely guaranteed. Yeah. Where do they have mutex and lock? So mutual exclusion is a different term. Mutex is a type of lock, is usually how people think of it. Or sometimes they just say it is a lock. I don't think there's like an established definition of what differentiates a mutex from just a lock. There are some terms for locks which suggest a particular implementation. For example, you might see the term spin lock. That's referring to a particular way of implementing locks. Mutexes usually don't in particular, though usually mutex, something that's called a mutex is implemented with the OS's help to like wait by running another process, but that's not, I think, not actually guaranteed by the name. And just POSIX calls their locks that are nice in that way mutexes, I think just for historical reasons. Other questions? Okay, oh, one thing I'd like to mention about locks, because some people will be tempted to do things. Pthread mutexes have this rule that you have to unlock from the same thread you locked in. I'm mentioning this because there might be some clever things you want to try to do that violate this rule. You're not allowed to do that, and that's because the lock could internally like track which thread called lock. It's allowed to do that, and some implementations, in fact, do that. Okay, so we're going to talk later about sort of coordinating threads. Okay, so we're going to talk about coordinating threads beyond locks. So I'll use this slide to introduce that. So, there's some things for sort of doing other operations that are just other than taking turns. So locks are a taking turns mechanism, and that's the most frequent thing we want to avoid, race conditions we talked about. We also want ways of waiting for events. And we're going to talk later about monitors here. The reading also talks about semaphores. We're not going to cover them, but they're another way that lets you do this. So locks don't really let us wait for an event. They're just for taking turns. And there's also some more specialized tools for some certain common patterns. So this waiting for events, these monitors and semaphores, turns out they can do kind of any type of waiting you can think of. They just handle all the problems of, I want this thread to run at this time. You can somehow make that work with monitors or or with semaphores. Might take a bit of work, but you can like basically encode any condition for make this thread run when this is true and have it happen. But there's some common patterns where we want to make that convenient, and one of them we're going to talk about in our last 5 minutes is barriers, and that's going to be the subject of a future assignment. And the reading also talks about reader-writer locks, which are another sort of common pattern. So if you remember sort of our examples of sort of introducing threads, we talked about like splitting up a computation among threads. And let's say we're doing a minimum operation. So we compute the minimum, let's say, of a big array. So we'd split that into two pieces, run those in separate threads, then we wait for them to finish, and then take the minimum of the sort of partial answers. And previously, the way we've seen of implementing this wait for all the things to finish operation is we have to join the threads. Now that's kind of annoying because it means we have to start a new set of threads every time. If we want to do a lot of these computations, this seems very expensive, and we're just starting threads and having the OS like set up new threads all the time, and we just like to keep the threads around, but we still want to do this wait for everything operation. And barriers provide us a tool just for implementing that wait for everyone operation. So barriers provide kind of two operations: initialize and wait. When we initialize a variable, we say, how many threads are we running? How many threads are going to wait on the barrier? And the wait operation, all the threads are going to call it, and it's not going to return until all the threads have started waiting. And this is for a very common pattern where we perform a bunch of computations in parallel, we wait for them all to finish, and do something with the results to move on. So for example, for a partial min operation, we initialize the barrier for two threads. In the two threads, we perform some partial answers. They both call wait. And the wait makes sure both of them are finished before we move on. And in the first thread I just arbitrarily chose, that's where I'm going to consolidate the answers. So questions on this pattern here? Yeah. So this is, so question, we feel like we sort of back to join. Yeah, so here, this doesn't seem much more useful than join. Where it is more useful is that, well, we could have multiple barriers, so we could keep thread 1 and 0 and 1 around and have them do this again without recreating the threads. With join, once we've joined, the thread can't run anymore. And what's going to make it even more useful is that these barriers are, in fact, reusable. So a very common pattern we'll have is that we'll be doing some simulation. So let's say you're the weather service and you want to simulate the weather. A common way you implement that is you sort of have some code running representing sort of each region of the Earth. It would look at the current state, compute what's the weather going to be 10 minutes later, and use that, then do that, and then you say, okay, let's use the 10 minute later weather to compute the later 20 minutes later, and so on. But when you do this, you don't just need this state in your area, you also want the stuff around you. So you want to have everyone compute the next step, wait for everyone to finish, then compute the next step, and barriers solve that problem excellently. So we can have this idea where we have our two threads, they get the result for time step 0, they wait after that, and wait for each other to finish, and then because we've waited, we know we can use the results from that first step to compute the second step. Then we can wait again, and this is going to ensure that the threads kind of run in lockstep, that each wait operation is going to wait for that step to finish. We call wait between each step, and the threads kind of do one step, wait for all that step to finish in every thread, do the next step, wait for that step to finish in every thread, and so on. And this is kind of where this is a very common pattern, and so we have this special tool for implementing it. And in pthreads, it's pthread barrier T, which you're going to use on the upcoming life assignment in a few weeks. Okay, and that's where I'll finish today. We'll review this later, closer to the life assignment. And next time we're going to talk, Professor Skadrin is going to talk about deadlock, which is going to be a problem with locks that we're going to want to avoid.